Welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pappy Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Go up and see them if you're looking for a John Deere, a mower, a tractor, implements, you name it. They've got it up there. They got a great inventory right now. They also do parts and service, and they're not that busy right now. If you want to run up there and get your mower tuned up or your tractor worked on, give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or go to the web and catch them at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
There you have it. All right, since there was so much falderall at the beginning of the first hour, no falderall this hour. Our guest is Bruce Sackman, and his book is super interesting. He also has a website, both same name, behindthemurdercurtain.com. And we have got all of his information posted and the other shows we've done with him. Today is December 3rd, 2023, and we appreciate you staying with us for another hour, Bruce, because honestly, we were talking about it in the break, and none of this can be done quickly.
No.
Like, you're a total story hour guy, and...
Yeah. Well, it's,
even though the stories are terrifying, we love hearing you tell them.
Yeah, we were talking about the power that hospital lobbies have and the amount of money that they can raise, and that's part of the reason it's very difficult to prosecute hospitals. Because let's face it, I mean, doctor comes in, he's got the white suit on. I mean, you have to believe him that he's doing the right thing for your health, and I would hope to think that 99.9% of the time they are doing the right thing or the best of their ability to get you fixed up and out of there. Nobody wants to be in a hospital, but you do have the bad eggs, and that's where it just seems like somebody needs to be liable for bad actors, and it sounds like a lot of this just gets swept under the rug.
Well, look, of course 99.9% of the time they're doing the right thing. I mean, look, in all my years working in the hospital, I can tell you that the overwhelming majority of healthcare professionals are the most honest, hardworking, dedicated, compassionate people I have ever met.
Absolutely.
And if it wasn't for these people, I would have never been able to successfully weed out the bad guys, because I wouldn't even know about them if they didn't come forward and talk to me about it. But, you know, if you think about it, if you're so inclined to either commit a murder or even a sexual assault, I mean, what profession might you choose and what location might you choose? You know, you want to work with a group of people. Look, if you want to kill people, if you join the mafia or if you join some outlaw motorcycle gang, well, that's the first place we're going to look for you. But if you're so inclined to kill people or to even sexually assault women, I mean, the last place we're probably going to look for you is a hospital, because to me, a hospital has always been, well, a sanctuary from crime, right?
Exactly.
You don't go to the hospital to first become a victim of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the hospital after you've been a victim of a crime to heal.
Well, and also you don't know the profession. You don't know the technical aspects of being a doctor, the drugs, the side effects, I mean, the procedures. It's all stuff that is totally foreign to most people, and so you're putting your faith and you're depending on people that have the training to do and apply the right techniques. You don't know if they're right or
but
wrong, so you
people,
have to trust them.
Yeah, even as I was looking up, I remembered we had a guy like that here in town, in Reading, and they didn't actually catch up with him until 2018, maybe a little bit. I think it went to court later than that. But he had victims back to 2005. And ultimately, it was he was a neurologist. 63 counts of sexually assaulting female patients. 63.
Yeah, you know, there are a number of these cases ongoing right now. I can tell you right now, just in the city of New York. There's a case involving a doctor by the name of Darius Paddock, a urologist, who was affiliated with multiple prominent academic medical centers in New York, and he was charged with sexually abusing patients, including minors, for years. There's a gastroenterologist, his name is Dr. Cheng, is charged with sexually assaulting unconscious patients and filming them at New York Presbyterian Queens Hospital, as well as assaulting other women at his home. I mean, both doctors, if convicted, could spend a lifetime in prison. I know at Harvard, there's a doctor, Derek Todd, a rheumatologist, who worked at Harvard's Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he's been accused of more than 100 women of performing unnecessary or inappropriate breast, pelvic, and rectal exams. Hello, management. Are you listening out there? You know, when did you know, and what did you know when? These are questions I think we have a right to know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is just cases in this area, and I'm sure there are cases like this going on all over the country. And, you know, I frequently get asked this question, whether it be doctors who allegedly perform sexual assault or murder patients, they say, do people enter the profession because they want to commit these crimes and get away with it? And my answer is, based on my own 30 years experience of doing these cases, for the most part, no. However, I think there are a couple of outliers. I believe that this one Dr. Haddon that we spoke about, who sexually assaulted 250 patients at Columbia, I believe that he became an OBGYN because he saw that as an opportunity to sexually assault patients.
Which is
so
hard, I mean, to comprehend that, because you look at the training and the schooling and the expense of becoming a doctor. And to have that in the back of your mind, hey, I'm going to be in a prime position to abuse people.
I always wonder, is it just the access that overwhelms
turn into that after the fact? But why would you? It just seems like a lot of expense and work goes into becoming a doctor, and then to turn. Man, that's just hard to understand.
Hey, Bruce, you mentioned the nurses being vilified for coming forward and blowing the whistle on medical professionals. You'd said that even if they blew the whistle on another nurse, it still went poorly. Do doctors come forward? I'm assuming they
yes.
do. But
Oh, yes. No.
Does that have more
they
horsepower
do.
When do. Another doctor comes forward? Or?
You know what? You would think so, but I haven't seen any examples of that. I think management will poo-poo them just as quickly as they would a nurse.
Okay.
You know, I could think of two doctors that came forth in the Richard Williams case in Columbia, Missouri. I mean, management just jumped all over them. And these were two prominent physicians because the manager, you know, was concerned about his own reputation and the reputation of the hospital, and he just poo-pooed whatever these doctors said. And in that particular case, it was doctors that came forward. So around the world, it's kind of a mix. I would say maybe more nurses have come forward than physicians, but a lot of physicians have come forward as well. So there's courage from both professions.
Yeah, I mean, look at the doctors that have come forward and kind of raise the alarm on the vaccine issue, and they've been just totally vilified.
Oh, yeah, that hasn't gone well
for going against the system. And now looking back, it's like, well, you know, they might not.
Interesting.
Have been
the
wrong.
Statistics have kind of borne that
mm-hmm.
out.
Yeah.
Yes. And didn't your state even have a law that kind of prevented them from saying any negative thing about it?
They tried.
The vaccine?
Yeah, they did. They ran a bill that didn't ultimately go through. But, yeah, the idea was that if you spoke up against the vaccine, that I think it also involved promoting any sort of, you know, holistic treatments or alternative things that they didn't, you know, that didn't include the shot. If you did that they could take your medical license, and at that point it was like, okay, that's not going to work. But they tried.
Yeah. So it's very tough, you know, it's very, very tough to blow the whistle. I mean, it's tough in other professions as well, but it's particularly tough here. And what kind of separates this from, I think, other professions is that your coworkers actually, and sometimes honestly, refuse to believe that a person who has taken an oath to save lives is intentionally taking lives.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they just find it very, very hard to believe. And they will search for explanations. You know, maybe the patients were extraordinarily sick. Maybe this nurse had more of the sickest patients than anyone else on the staff, which is fine. You know, they will search for legitimate reasons. But, you know, especially when you work with someone, sometimes for many, many years, it's very, very tough to accept the fact that that person that sometimes you've had dinner with, sometimes you've gone to their home,
mm-hmm.
and now all of a sudden they're accused of hurting people. You know, I had a case at the VA where a VA attorney, had embezzled the funds from incompetent veterans. You know, these incompetent veterans, they had special accounts set aside because they couldn't handle their own money. And this VA attorney who was responsible for monitoring these accounts actually helped himself to the money and took the money.
Wow. Nice
and he got prosecuted. And when I went to his boss and laid out the case for his boss refused to believe it. He said, I've worked with this guy for many, many years. He's been to my home. I trust him. I can't really believe this is happening. And he wouldn't believe it until the day we went to federal court. And this lawyer admitted in front of court that he had embezzled the money from funds from incompetent veterans. Until that time, his boss refused to believe it.
Wow.
You know, I remember when I was working in the private sector, a number of small practices were bought out by the hospitals. They were taken over by the hospitals because it was very difficult for small practices to exist by themselves. And what we would do is we would go in and we would do audits of the practice. And lo and behold, we would discover that the practice manager had been stealing money from the physicians for years.
Uh-huh.
And unbeknownst to them, of course.
Hmm.
And when we laid it out to them, often they refused to believe it. They said, are you kidding me? This woman has been here for 10 years. She knows my family. She babysits for my kids. She wouldn't do anything like that. And sometimes people have a very tough time believing that their coworkers, particularly in the healthcare setting, where people have taken the Hippocratic Oath or Florence Nightingale Oath to save lives, is intentionally taking lives. It's very, very hard. Very, very hard to believe.
When you're in, you know, you get the case. There's been allegations, and you're investigating. Do you find that the people that you interview are typically cooperative, or are they like, do they kind of steer away from you and not really want to talk to you?
Well, I would say it's kind of a mixed bag, you know.
Depends on how guilty they are.
we get people that are very afraid.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to spend a lot of time putting their mind at ease as best we can. They're very, very afraid to talk. And there are others, once in a few, you know, you get a few bold people who come right out and they'll tell you exactly how they feel. But there are other people that are really afraid to say anything. They'll run to their union rep, you know, I want to have my union rep here. And but you're not in trouble. You're not being accused of anything. I don't care. I want to have my union rep. I'm afraid for my job. Okay, bring your union rep. Bring your grandma. I don't care who you bring with you. You know, but we're going to have to talk. We're going to have this discussion. And then at first, you know, they're afraid to answer. They, like, answer yes, no, you know. But then after a while, and this is takes a lot of oral surgery, but after a while, they start to disclose exactly what they feel. But it's not easy for some, and then for others, they don't stop talking.
Yeah.
They keep on going. You know,
I've
run into both. Yeah.
Well, you would think most people, when they come forward, you know, they've thought about it for a long time, and you know, they've decided to pull the trigger on that. And I feel the worst for those folks, because then when the system says, "Oh, we're not going to do anything," I mean, that just winds up being incomprehensible for people. We have to take another quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Bruce Sackman. He has a website that I think you should go check out. It is behindthemurdercurtain.com, and you can find all of that on our site at wethepeopleradio.us.
Pretty frightening, but you know the chances are so small. Stuck by bee sting, nothing but a bee thing. Better chance you're gonna buy at the mall. But it's a 23 or 4 to 1 that you can fall in love by the end of this song. So get up, tell the bookie, put a bet on not a damn thing will go wrong. The odds are that we will probably be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright tonight.
Can you confirm those odds, Mr. Sackman?
Are we going to be all right?
What are the odds?
Yeah, we're going to be fine. You know, by the way, about 2 weeks ago, there was a case in the newspaper, I don't know if you guys caught it, about a nurse in Pennsylvania who confessed to killing 19 patients with insulin. Did you happen to see that one?
No.
All right, her name is Heather Presti, P-R-E-S-S-D-E-E. And people were so shocked by this, and they asked some of these questions. The prosecutor said, this is one of the worst cases we have seen with someone in the healthcare system going from facility to facility and, unfortunately, admitting to killing multiple people. No, it's not. We've seen this all over the world, Mr. Prosecutor. No, it is not. The family wants to know how Ms. Presti managed to work at 11 rehabilitation facilities over 5 years and kill people.
Oh, wow.
This is like a couple of weeks ago, right? According to a lawsuit, the staff members at the center began to notice that Ms. Presti was exhibiting, quote, troubling behavior, and that the health of the patients in her care would unexpectedly deteriorate. Yeah, and did so. What happened? Several staff members, the lawsuit states, began referring to her as the killer nurse while she's still working there. While she's still working there. Witnesses told investigators, according to the complaint, that Ms. Presti denigrated people in her care and made comments such as, "When is she going to die already?" Okay.
Wow.
And, you know, the prosecutor said in their news release that Ms. Presti had usually administered the insulin during overnight shifts when staff was low. because most of my medical serial killers love to work, pardon the pun, that 3 a.m., what do they call it again? The 3 a.m. shift.
The graveyard.
All right. The graveyard shift. All right. And so, you see, all these things here, we've seen these many times before. This isn't new. These are red flags. It's enough already. Time to stop. Am I going to read about another one of these cases in another month or two from now? Yeah, I can tell you there's a couple of them ongoing right now as we speak. All right? There's a couple of cases ongoing, and they were associated with the COVID. Because if you remember, during COVID, patients, the hospitals did not allow their families to come visit them. So that gave people an opportunity. Well, you didn't even have to wait for the graveyard shift then because the families weren't allowed in the hospital during COVID. And there's a case ongoing right now in Canada. All right? Right now in Canada, the doctor's name is Dr. Brian Nadler. He's accused of killing four patients during COVID. And there's also a case in Germany ongoing where a doctor is accused of killing patients during COVID because as easy as it was to kill patients in a hospital regularly, during COVID, it was even that much easier. All right.
Oh, yeah. Nobody could visit anybody.
That's right.
Hospitals were empty.
That's right. So that's what's ongoing right now, in the world of medical serial killers. And every couple of weeks, a new one surfaces somewhere, and the story's the same. You know, they work to midnight, that they work the graveyard shift. People suspected them of killing patients. Every time this nurse is on duty, the death rate goes up. The nurse takes a vacation, the death rate goes down. The patients were not expected to expire when they did. They're all the same stories. The sad thing is the stories keep continuing and keep coming, and it's about time it stopped.
Yeah, and so if you were going to make some sort of a change, what would that look like to prevent this?
There are a number of things I would do. We talked about some of it before, but I would talk about changing the law to make it easier for prosecutors to prosecute those managers that truly aid and abet these medical serial killers or these physicians who commit numerous sexual assaults against patients. That's the first thing. The second thing I would do is make it easier for the whistleblowers. I would give financial incentives to them so when the hospital is fined, the whistleblower can receive a percentage of that fine or penalty against the hospital, and that would give them a financial incentive to come forward. Plus, it would cover their legal fees as well. Then it's a matter of training, all right? You have to train the staff on the red flags on how to identify these people, because as I showed you, the cases are very similar all around the world. That last case we went through, a number of red flags existed in that case, but nothing happened. So it's a matter of training as well. And that's something that I've done. I mean, I've gone around to a lot of healthcare organizations, and I talk about the red flags, and I do all the training that I can for them. And you know something interesting? When I address these medical professionals, and they're a wonderful audience, and they're all very interested, and they're very concerned, inevitably, someone will come up to me after my presentation and say, you know, Bruce, we had this doctor who worked here, we had this nurse who worked here, and we just kind of suspected something. We thought something was going on. We thought he may have been intentionally harming people, but, we couldn't really prove it, and we talked about it, and then he moved on to another hospital, so we just forgot about it. You don't know how many times I've been approached by people telling me that same story. Is that scary or what?
Yeah, terrifying.
It really is.
And then, Do they? Do you find that these people? I would imagine once they carve themselves a niche, they stay there. But the smart thing to do would be to move around. Do they carve the niche or move around?
Well, you know what? It depends. Some of them move around. I would say some of them are kind of forced to move around because the management makes it uncomfortable for them, but gives them an option, you know, whether they're going to pursue the matter or they'll find another job. So, of course, they find another job. As a nurse, Cullen worked in about 10 different hospitals. Many of those hospitals suspected something. Never called the police. Never even cooperated with the police once he was charged. And he moved around to 10 hospitals. Niles Hogel in Germany moved around the hospital. So
Swango was in a different country, wasn't he?
Yes. Swango was actually in Zimbabwe, Africa, where he killed women and children and pregnant women and poisoned his landlady. And just went on and on and on until he had to return to the United States, and eventually he was successfully prosecuted here. But these cases, from an investigative standpoint, take a lot of time and a lot of money, something that a lot of local police departments don't have. First of all, well, most cops don't become cops because they're good in chemistry and biology. So they're very, very dependent on the doctors. They don't want to go in the hospital. They don't want to do investigations in the hospital. You know, they have this HIPAA law, this Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. What records can I get with a subpoena? What records do I need a court order for? Does the judge have to sign it? Do they have to give me everything? Are there some things they don't have to give me? And I don't understand the science. I mean, I don't understand what could have harmed these people. And lastly, the management is telling the officer this. The officer shows up and the management is saying, thank you very much, officer, for your concern. You know, we were just as concerned as you are here at the hospital. So we did our own internal investigation. Y'all, we put together a board of our very best doctors and nurses, and they reviewed the cases. And we came to the conclusion that all the patients expired as a direct result of their natural disease processes. Now, if you want to continue that investigation, officer, knock yourself out. But this is the conclusion we've come to. So how many police departments, particularly smaller police departments, are just going to say, thank you very much, Mr. Hospital President, and close the case and go on to something else? And that's another reason why so many medical serial killers get away with murdering so many patients.
Yeah.
Well, it would, because you look at an investigation like that, and if you're not a specialist in any of that, I mean, you have investigated these cases. How much expertise did you have to amass before you were kind of conversant in all that? When you start looking, like,
well, that's what I mean. I mean, okay, it's just a different lingo. Everything is,
because what I'm thinking of is I did have a situation where I had some people come to me, and it was about a facility that had seniors, and they said, well, there were tons of medication errors, thousands of medication errors. Now I'm thinking that means they're giving the wrong medication to people, but there's a huge range of things that qualify as a medication error. And I thought, the farther I got into it, the more I realized, I don't know what's good, what's bad. If I even looked at the records, would I know what I was looking at?
Well, that's why, those are excellent points. And that's why it requires a team of people to do these cases. All right. When we did the Swango case, I had never done any homicide case before in my life. I had done every other conceivable crime that could occur in a hospital, but I didn't do a homicide case. But fortunately for me, I met up with a forensic pathologist named Dr. Michael Bodden. Michael Bodden has been on TV many times. He has a show called Autopsy. And I said, how do we do this, Doc? And he says, well, this is what we're going to do, and this is what we did with Swango. He says, first thing we're going to do is assemble a team. And this team is going to consist of himself as a forensic pathologist and my group as investigators. But also, we need a physician who's expert on chart review. He could look at a patient's chart and make a determination as to whether or not that patient should have expired when he did.
Uh-huh.
Right. Also, what we gathered up was a group at that time, a relatively new profession, known as forensic nursing. Forensic nurses were phenomenal. These are nurses that are trained in both forensic science and nursing science. And they had a great idea of everything that was going on, including the hospital administration and the science. And they could kind of dumb down the science to lay people like myself so we could actually get a pretty good idea of what was going on. And lastly, you know, we needed a toxicologist. Somebody to make a determination as to whether these people were poisoned, and if so, what the poisons were. So, you know, I don't care if you're the reincarnation of Sherlock Holmes. One investigator cannot do this case by him or herself. It literally takes not only a team of people, but it takes a load of money, a load of resources to do this. And unless you have a team, and unless your this team is well financed, you're going to lose.
So when you say it takes a lot of money, is that to pay the people that are involved in the investigation?
In part, but it's also to sometimes pay for external lab work.
Oh,
you know, in the case of Swango, the FBI declined to do our toxicology for us. Okay, because they had done a somewhat similar case, and they were unsuccessful, and they didn't want to touch it. So we had to go to the largest private civilian forensic lab in the country, the Reader's Lab in Pennsylvania, and it cost us like $100,000 in lab fees.
Yeah.
How many police departments have that kind of money?
Yeah.
They drop $100,000 on lab fees. And then you're talking about bringing people in and paying for their hotels, sometimes for months and months at a time. It's a very expensive proposition.
Sure.
All right. Now, in the federal government, well, you know, money's no object. But if you're in a local police department and you got a tight budget, you're going to look for a reason not to do these cases.
Mm-hmm. Or hand it off to
many
somebody.
Parts of the world.
Yeah,
you're not working with other people's money. Well, with the VA, how much? Darn it. We have to take a really quick break again. Booey! All right, when we come back, I'm asking you about the VA because I got questions.
Sure.
So many questions. So let's see. Our guest here is Bruce Sackman. And talking about murder. Nice little break from politics. You go from politics to murder, back to politics. You know what the heck? Why not? You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
And we take them out and show ourselves when everyone has gone. Some are satin, some are steel, some are silk and some are leather. They're the faces of the stranger, but we love to try them on. You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay. For good.
Or Bruce Sackman puts him in jail. Okay, so with the different things at VA, not just hospitals and clinics, but you also have VA, you have veterans' homes.
Yes, we have what we call extended care centers. Yes,
because out here we've got Yountville, and you know we have some big ones. We have one here in Reading, and those are run by CalVet. Those are state; they're not VA. But
yes, there are state-run homes, and there are federal homes. The state-run homes in New York and Connecticut had terrible, terrible COVID-related problems. Mm. I don't know about out in California, but in New York, many, many veterans expired at these state-run veterans' homes unnecessarily. In fact, there was a big Justice Department investigation. They said it was so bad that the veterans' civil rights were actually violated in the homes during COVID.
Right.
But did any manager get prosecuted? Well, we know the answer. We don't even have to ask that anymore. We know the answer to that. All right. Many, many deaths in Connecticut and in New Jersey in the state-run homes. Terrible, terrible.
And and why do you think that that is? How do you find the accountability there? How is that working?
You know, because it was a state home, I never actually had the opportunity to go into a state home or to do an investigation in a state home, because it didn't really fall under my purview. But I could tell you that I recall one time going into the VA, the Federal Extended Care Center, in Queens, and it was not pretty. It was not a pretty sight, and we helped clean that place up. But, you know, the thing is about nursing homes and extended care centers, many times the residents there, they don't really get visited by their families much. So there's really not much pressure on the staff to do the right thing. And sometimes things just kind of slip away. And the next thing you know, especially during a pandemic, if it's not done properly, people are going to die. And that's what happened to a terrible extent in New Jersey and in Connecticut.
Yeah, and that was kind of a, I remember we did a show with a researcher out of Canada where they were moving a lot of the COVID patients to rest homes, basically putting COVID in all those different places. They moved a handful of them into like 40 different rest homes instead of grouping them together and taking care of it. So I think there were a lot of things that went on. I don't know if we're ever going to get to the bottom of that. 2020 and
yeah,
all the things.
I can tell you that the state was sued and the states had to pay out a lot of money, and that's kind of the routine in these things. You know, the state gets sued or the government gets sued and they pay out a lot of money, but nobody actually gets charged or even loses their job usually at all.
Interesting.
You know, and
and do you find that with the private hospitals versus, like, say, VA facilities, you know, federal facilities, because you've investigated both, is the, because you already laid out for us, like, the management issues, like, if, you know, if we bring this to light, then everyone's going to think our facility is terrible, you know, that kind of thing. Is it the same in both, or do you notice any difference? Is that just a medical facility issue, or does it matter what system you're in?
You know, I don't have enough experience with the extended care centers. My experience was very, very limited with the nursing homes, with the extended care centers. So I don't want to say anything that I'm not 100% positive about.
How about in the actual hospitals, like VA hospital versus, you know, regular, you know, public hospital?
You know, there are some great VA hospitals, and there are some not-so-great VA hospitals. Remember, there are over 100 VA hospitals.
Right.
They're not all created equal. In fact, not every department on every floor is created equal. I mean, you could have an outstanding department on the third floor and a lousy department on the fourth floor. But I would say that most veterans are satisfied with the treatment that they receive at the VA. That doesn't mean there aren't plenty of horror stories. I mean, real horror stories. But given that it's over 100 hospitals, any hospital system, whether it be private or public, with over 100 hospitals, you're going to have some really serious problems in.
Sure.
That's just the way it is.
Well, and then with, you know, between Obamacare and COVID and all that stuff, we have really reduced the number of physicians out there in all capacities, you know, whether they're GPs or neurologists or whatever. So I guess what I'm percolating in the back of my mind is that that fuels opportunity for, bad things, maybe.
I was just reminded, you know, about in Jersey when the DOJ came out their report, and they did a report, I think, jointly with the state. They quoted a worker from one of the homes as describing it as pure hell.
Yikes.
This is a worker. And Menlo Park in New Jersey as a battlefield. And the report said that the home's dysfunctional management style and poor communications contributed to staffing shortages. I'm reading from the report, limiting their ability to keep residents safe. At Menlo Park, staff members feared retaliation. At both homes, Veterans Affairs leaders often appeared indifferent and even hostile to employees' concerns.
Wow.
Doesn't this sound repetitive already?
Yeah. Well, there is really a pattern. So if you, all right. So from a useful standpoint, so we realize there's a very, you know, finite, small, and small number of doctors. There's a larger pool, but still small number of nurses. But there are tons of patients and a zillion family members and friends of patients. So it seems like we would be, you know, all of us would be kind of a great resource. How would you smarten up the public as both patients and friends of patients on what
to do? This is what I'll tell members of my own family or people that I discuss this with. It's very important when going into some sort of medical center institution that the patient is not by themselves, that the patient actually has an advocate with them, a family member who politely and respectfully asks questions and takes notes. Because, look, if I'm inclined to harm a patient or do something bad, I'm not going to do something when the family's there asking questions and taking notes, okay? I'm going to go on to the next person who maybe never gets a visit. I mean, this happens a lot in our veterans' homes, you know. Families never come visit them. There are poor vets who sit there and they haven't seen their families in years. That's who I'm going to pick on because nobody's going to complain.
Nobody's going to notice.
Easy target.
That's right. I'm not going to pick on somebody that has a really sharp family member there asking questions. And I'm not saying to interfere or, you know, to be a pain in the ass. But what I'm saying is to politely and respectfully make your presence known and take notes and ask questions. And that's the best thing you could do to keep your family member safe.
Yeah. And just really pay attention. How many of these, some of these people, like the nurse that confessed after how many years? How many years was she was killing people?
Well, there are many, many, many different nurses. I don't know which one you're talking about. But
I'm thinking of the last one you spoke about.
Yeah, the last one. Let me see. I think the last one.
This was like a lot of years.
I thought he said it was like 10 years.
Since 2018.
Okay.
Since 2018. Okay. So, you know, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah.
So you're a hospital, you know, you're working in a hospital or some facility or whatever, and you have patients die on your watch. Now that happens anyway, because
of course
not everybody who goes in comes out, like, and that's legit,
right?
That happens,
right? That's
so
right.
I mean, that's not always an indicator either, right?
Well, no, but it seems like every time Nurse Erin is on duty, the death rate goes up. Nurse Aaron takes a vacation, the death rate goes down. But you know what's interesting about Nurse Aaron's patients?
They have a great time while they're in there? Oh, no, that's not
it. No, they weren't expected to expire when they did. In fact, many times they were actually improving, and the family would come visit them and say, oh, I could go on vacation now, only to get a call from Nurse Aaron saying that their dad or mom passed unexpectedly. That's a big difference.
That is
because,
big difference.
You know, if you've ever had a loved one that's really, really ill in the hospital, maybe near death, you knew they were near death, the staff knew, their death didn't come as a real shock to anyone, all right? But these are people that weren't expected to expire. In fact, many times they're actually improving, and that's the big difference.
So you're a family member of somebody that fits that scenario, and that evil Nurse Aaron gets their grip on them, and then suddenly they're no longer going on vacation. They are not coming home at all. You start asking questions, but again, you're not an expert, and you're not the police, and how do you get somebody interested in looking into it? If you have...
Well, that's usually where the civil side comes. You know, that's when many of these cases actually start as a result of a civil suit, where the family actually sues the hospital, gets a hold of a malpractice attorney and a private investigator, and then the information comes out, and that turns into a government criminal case. Mm. So many times, and I think that was the case in Pennsylvania here as well, it started out as a civil case. And, you know, it's actually easier to make a civil case than a criminal case because the burden of proof is different. In a civil case, you only have to prove 51% of the evidence, what they call a preponderance of the evidence, where in a criminal case, it's beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's a much higher burden.
And do they typically go after the doctor, or do they go after the management?
Well, they'll go after everyone, but this is only for monetary damages.
Sure. Right.
So they'll go after everyone. But in the case of Richard Williams at the VA Medical Center, when the FBI and the VA came to the conclusion that they cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Richard Williams had murdered patients, the family sued, and the family won. And the judge said, in his opinion, Richard Williams did murder these patients. However, there wasn't enough evidence to convince the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. But as far as civil proof goes, that 51% of the evidence did exist. So many times the cases either go that route, or they start that route and then morph into a criminal case.
If they get, I know we're running out of time here. If they get convicted on a civil case, that doesn't typically remove them from the system. But I would think that their malpractice insurance would probably drop if they have a giant claim against them. Do you find that to be the case?
No, I actually find that these doctors usually pick up and find another hospital to work with. And, they may have to pay a little bit more, but even the medical boards don't usually go after these people. So, they just continue.
So it's kind of all about staying healthy and paying attention.
That's certainly
in
helpful.
That order. Well, I think we'll have to sign off with you today, Bruce. Thank you so much for coming on with us again. We love hearing your stories, although they're terrifying. And if you missed the beginning of the show, you should definitely catch it on the archive at
wethepeopleradio.us.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good, so good. I got you. Oh, I feel nice. A sugar and spice.